mouth.
Word of 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 mouth.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Among today's sports news, Boston's Paul Pierce sinks a three-pointer over LeBron James to edge out Miami in the Eastern Conference Finals. And a New Orleans Saints linebacker says the bounty scandal is overblown. We normally wouldn't hear about a Division III track meet in Columbus, Ohio, but for distance runner Megan Vogel, she stopped 20 meters short of winning the 3200 to help a collapsed runner from another school to her feet and across the finish line. Videos and photos of Vogel's selfless sporting spirit have gone viral. Athletes inspire that kind of passion and controversy and expectation and disappointment, as no other figures do. Writer Stephen Amidon writes about the emotional and physical power of athletes, somehow proof of our desire to exceed physical limitations and become something like gods. That's the name of his new book. It's a cultural history of the athlete from Achilles to LeBron. And Stephen Amidon joins us now from Argo Studios in New York. Great to have you back on Word of Mouth, Stephen.
Great to be here, Virginia.
So let's begin with your own love of sports and your first visit to Yankee Stadium in 1969. What do you remember from that day?
Well, it was bat day. And, you know, it was a more innocent, happier time in America, because here we are in the South Bronx with tens of thousands of boys being given actual baseball bats. Yeah, it's not something I think would actually happen today. But I went there. It was my first trip to Yankee Stadium, and I was enthralled. It was like stepping into a cathedral or the Grand Canyon. And in fact, it was better, because I've been in cathedrals and I've been in the Grand Canyon, and they don't come close to a 10-year-old boy stepping into Yankee Stadium. I was also wanted to see the trajectory of a hit, evidently, by acclaim, the greatest home run ever hit by Mickey Mantle, which had happened 5 years earlier. And I had a picture of this in a little picture book I had of sports, great moments in sports history. And so I just will never forget sitting there and watching and looking at the facade, the part of the roof of the stadium where this ball had hit.
11th inning hit by Mickey Mantle against the Kansas City A's. Everybody present on that mythical day swore they'd never heard anything like the bat cracking. And when you write about it, we can almost hear it and imagine the cheers. There is something kind of transporting and instantly emotional. What are we keying into?
Well, I think at his best, the athlete, Mickey Mantle, Muhammad Ali, Jesse Owens, whoever, David Beckham, at his best, he does something magical. He stops, or she stops, time and takes us out of our lives. You know, when we see a home run like that, or we watch a putt going towards the hole on the 18th green at Augusta, we no longer are thinking about our mortgages or difficult jobs or difficult relationships. We're in a different place. It's almost timeless. It's intense. It's powerful. It's young. You know, it's a really great place to be. And the athlete sort of magically transports us there. And that's, I think, one of the reasons we really value the athlete, you know, so greatly.
Well, you write about the athlete also as kind of embodying the ethos of the era. And in this case, in the public and the private era, you later discovered that Mickey Mantle had a facade of his own. He's not quite the golden boy on the baseball cards of our youth.
Well, one of the great changes in the athletes in the past 50, 75 years is that we've got to know a lot more about them as people. You know, when Babe Ruth was hitting home runs at Yankee Stadium, the house that Ruth built, sports writers there was almost a conspiracy. Well, there was a conspiracy among sports writers to protect his image. You know, Grantland Rice, the dean of American sports writers, said, if you're not in the business of making heroes, you shouldn't be a sports writer. And so they knew about Ruth's drinking and his womanizing and his gambling, and they deliberately did not tell us about it. And this extended all the way into the 1960s. You know, and into the 70s. And things were kept from us. You know, the details of Joe DiMaggio's marriage to Marilyn Monroe, for instance, and Mickey Mantle's drinking. Nowadays, of course, it's quite the opposite. With the internet and all sorts of other things, we probably know too much about athletes. I mean, we know the squalid details of Tiger Woods' marriage, for instance. And you know, there's been a great reversal there.
Well, were you crestfallen when you found that out? I mean, why do we get so disappointed in the failings of athletes? It's not like we married Tiger Woods or can expect a certain code of conduct. I wonder if we project something on that that's not fair.
We absolutely do. And you know, I think what we project on them is what they give us at their great moments of performance, you know, and we see that as being pure and strong and godlike. You know, the Greek poet Pindar said, people are never like the gods. The gods are one thing and humanity is something else. But people can become something like the gods when at this moment of athletic excellence, which to him was, of course, in the ancient Olympics. And I think, you know, there's a real disappointment there especially when young people learn that these embodiments of grace and perfection aren't that way. I learned about Mickey Mantle's drinking when I was reading a book called Ball 4, which Jim Boughton wrote, you know, which actually was kind of a strange experience because I love the book so much. And yet at the same time, I was being disillusioned.
We're talking about the athletic, emotional, and social power of athletes. Stephen Amidon is with us. He's a sports lover, multiple-time novelist, and author of a new nonfiction book exploring the cultural history of the athlete called Something Like the Gods. Well, let's look at this idea of the gods. You write about Joe Louis as a transformative figure. And I remember, I think it was reading David Remnick's book about Muhammad Ali. There was a story of a black inmate being put to death in a southern prison. And as the fumes surrounded him and he began to suffocate, he was shouting, "Save me, Joe Louis, save me." This appeal to some superhuman power.
Well, that's right. I mean, that's one of the great stories, apocryphal stories. It may or may not be true,
right,
but it certainly sounds true. I mean, we believe it's true. You know, Joe Louis was an interesting character, was an interesting figure, as was Jesse Owens. You know, both of them were adopted by the United States during the run-up to the Second World War as embodiments of American values, you know, freedom, you know, everything that the Nazis were not, you know. And Louis famously fought Max Schmeling, and as we know, Jesse Owens ran in front of Hitler at his Aryan, at his Nazi Olympics. You know, the irony being, of course, that neither, being African Americans, both of these men did not really have much freedom at all back in the United States, and both came back to kind of very complicated and difficult lives after their triumphs. So there's a bittersweet quality to someone, you know, seeing Joe Louis as being godlike, because although he had godlike performances and was able to beat Schmeling and have this acclaim, you know, he didn't really have a lot of power outside the ring.
Let's get to the role of race also in the sports arena that we saw later. Joe Louis, Jackie Robinson, you mentioned famously the 1968 Olympics when Tommy Smith, Peter Norman, and John Carlos won the gold, silver, and bronze respectively in the 200 meter in the Mexico City Olympics. Let's just hear a little bit of the race.
This is the hottest 200 meter field ever assembled at the Olympic Games. Second attempt now to get them away. Peter Norman did get a good start, I thought. Smith is doing well. His leg seems to be standing up okay. Look at Carlos go in the center of the field, and Questad is not beaten by any means. Peter Norman running beautifully, and he's got them heading into the 100 meters. Peter Norman is flying on the outside. Here comes Eigen Herr of West Germany. He's a threat. So too is the Trinidadian Roberts in the center of the field. It's Tommy Smith running through, and Peter Norman runs a play.
Tommy Smith, a surprise win there. John Carlos, both expelled from the games after raising gloved fists, wearing bare feet, and a Black Power salute during the medaling ceremony. An incredibly potent image and an act that was both galvanizing and divisive. What was going on behind the scenes?
Well, what was going on behind the scene was that, you know, people believe the Olympics should be pure, should be free of politics. And so a lot of the outrage, you know, stemmed from the belief that they had in some way sullied this stage of purity and athletic, you know. But you know, the irony of their protest was that, you know, there were not black officials at the Olympics. There was still a lot of racism going on, you know, inside and outside of the Olympics at the time. And the person who banned them for life, Avery Brundage, had really, you know, in 1936, had really kowtowed to Adolf Hitler to get the Olympics into Berlin. He was the head of the American Olympic Committee at the time. And, you know, Avery Brundage was very quick to suspend two African Americans for raising their fists, but he didn't make a peep when Germans performed the Nazi salute to Hitler after winning gold medals in 1936. So there's a real irony there. I think over the years, people have come to accept that, you know, the Smith and Carlos's protest, you know, had a lot of legitimacy to it. And it wasn't self-interested. I mean, these were young men in the prime of their careers, and they knew they were risking everything, and yet they did it. And what strikes me reading about it from this remove is nobody, you know, all the American sports writers were just outraged, and nobody thought to ask, why would they do that? Why would they give up so much? And if they'd only asked that, maybe the focus would have been put on poverty and hunger among African Americans a lot sooner than it was.
But they were in the position. They had the power. They had the means to do that. We put them, the audience put them in that place. What is the role of the audience here?
Well, you know, the audience is you know, I think it's twofold. On the one hand, you know, and you, this goes back to you talking about disillusionment of Mickey Mantle or Tiger Woods. You know, on the one hand, we invest them with this incredible power, you know, to be spokesmen for products, to be political spokesmen. And on the other hand, there's often a sort of bristling when they actually become human and take advantage of that power. I mean, you know, really. You know, nobody wants – people get very uneasy when athletes start talking about politics or racial matters. And yet, you know, we – on the other hand, we hang on their every word and we invest them with perhaps more power than they should have, because these are physically trained, you know, very focused performers. And just because you can, you know, shoot a three-pointer doesn't mean you really have much insight into the political system in America. And yet, you know, we really do, you know, give them that. And then we're disappointed when they don't say the things we want them to say.
It's an odd role for a hero. But let's look at, I mean, the off-field behavior of Babe Ruth, reckless, dismissed by sports writers as harmless hijinks, as you say. But can we extend this veneration, this behavior of heroism and cover-ups to those who stood by silent when Mark Sandusky, soon to be tried on charges of raping children, was accused, heard, even seen abusing kids?
You know, I think the Sandusky case really may, hopefully, it's a bit of a one-off. It's a bit of an isolated case that stems from a community in Penn State, which was so dominated by – it was almost like a company town, you know, the football team there. And there was so much money, so much power placed in that thing that perhaps people – you know, definitely people's judgments got badly skewered. You know, what's going on now in sports is that there's so much money, even on a college football level. I mean, hundreds of millions of dollars in just in college football programs, that, you know, that kind of money in anything will skewer people's values. And I think you have to be doubly careful, you know, to sort of make sure you watch out for that, you know. But I don't think that what happened in the Sandusky case is really necessarily part of athletics or college football. I think it's more a case of a huge corporation, you know, that just lost its way.
Well, let's go back to the headlines. We heard the high stakes and grand show of athleticism, reprehensible behavior, and then this show of true compassion and sportsmanlike behavior by a high school senior in Ohio. Is that what keeps us going, even if it looks, you know, we could become cynical about sports? Is that the spirit that draws us back?
You know, time and again, every time and being cynical about sports is not something new. I mean, if you read the ancient Greeks, you know, there were people back then who were incredibly cynical about the sports mad Greeks. And the Greeks were as sports crazy as we are. And this is something that extends through, you know, the 19th century and the 20th century. And every time, you know, that you think we've reached the breaking point, whether it be steroids, whether it be, you know, the Nazi Olympics, what have you, you know, there will be these moments, these galvanizing moments. I saw that video yesterday, and it is remarkable. I would urge everybody to look at it. You know, it's like the moment in World War II when the Dynamo Kiev soccer team had been reconstituted after the conquest of Ukraine by the Nazis. The Nazis reconstituted this soccer team so they could play them and beat them. Dynamo Kiev was a great team, and they would send teams of SS soldiers to compete against them. And Dynamo Kiev couldn't do it. They kept on winning, even though they knew the stakes. They knew that they had to lose against these German teams. They'd be down 3 goals at the end of the game, and they'd score four goals and win. And they wound up, a lot of them, being sent to labor camps and dying. But you know, that's really what the athlete is about, is those transcendent moments that I talked about right at the beginning of our conversation that take us to a place that's almost, you know, a little bit beyond being human. And you know, it keeps on happening. And every time you want to give up, you know, you'll get a new moment.
Stephen Amendon, I want to thank you for joining us today.
Oh, it's been my pleasure entirely.
Stephen Amidon, author of 6 novels and co-author of The Sublime Engine. His new book is called Something Like the Gods, A Cultural History of the Athlete from Achilles to LeBron. You can also find a link to the book and more reviews at our competitive website, wordofmouthradio.org.
Now let us talk about the brown bomber. Let us tell the nation this story. Let us talk about the brown bomber. Joe Louis was a fighting man. Well, let us talk about the brown bomber. Tell the nation this story. Let us talk about the brown bomber. Joe Louis was a fighting man.
Well, thanks for coming out to play today. Please join us again at noon and again at 9 tomorrow for more Word of Mouth. You can also catch us anytime online at wordofmouthradio.org.
In the state of ALA, he's a farmer boy, so I was told he hadn't mother wit in his heart until one day.